Welcome to a series of podcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Jeremy Waldron, university professor at New York University Law School, speaks on the topic whether it's ever appropriate for American judges to be influenced in their decision by what they know of the laws of other countries. The Storrs Lectures, one of Yale Law School's oldest and most prestigious lecture programs, addresses fundamental problems of law and jurisprudence. This is lecture two of a three-part lecture series.
I wanted to explore some issues about integrity. In 2003, a young man called Paul Hopkinson set fire to a flag on the grounds of the New Zealand Parliament in Wellington. He was arrested, charged, and convicted of an offense under the Flags, Emblems, and Names Protection Act of 1981, a statute which makes it an offense to destroy the New Zealand flag with the intention of dishonoring it. Mr. Hopkinson appealed on the ground that burning a flag in protest, which is what he was doing, was not a way of dishonoring the flag, at least not under any interpretation of the word dishonor that would avoid conflict with the free speech provisions of the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act. To understand that, it helps to know that New Zealand has a form of very weak judicial review, which doesn't permit courts to strike down legislation, but which requires them to choose among available interpretations, the interpretation that avoids conflict with the provisions of the Bill of Rights. The court, hearing the appeal, had no doubt that prohibiting Mr. Hopkinson's conduct would be prima facie a breach of his right to freedom of expression. But like many modern bills of rights, the New Zealand one allows rights to be qualified by such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. It has that sort of standard limitation clause. You can be subject to such reasonable limits prescribed by law as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. And so the court had to consider whether the protection of the flag satisfied that test. Mr. Hopkinson said, look, we're a multicultural society. Who cares about the flag? It's not even a reasonable objective of government. The judge, Justice Ellen France, disagreed. She said, I believe the objective remains an important one. In Texas against Johnson, 1989 case from the United States, the United States Supreme Court ruled that Texas flag burning legislation was unconstitutional, but it did consider that the state's aims of preserving the flag as a symbol of national unity and preventing breaches of the peace were legitimate objectives. So that was the New Zealand court's first reference to foreign law in Hopkinson. The second came when Justice France turned to consider whether a ban on flag burning was a rational and proportionate means of promoting this legitimate objective. She noted the disagreement on this matter among justices in the United States and Texas and Johnson and in some subsequent decisions. And she also referred to a number of cases from a number of countries. She referred to a case from Hong Kong involving the mutilation of the Chinese flag, where the Hong Kong court upheld a flag protection statute on grounds of special exigencies of public order having to do with the novelty. It was shortly after the establishment of the new regime in Hong Kong, so having to do with the newness of its constitutional arrangements and the delicacy of its position in relation to the rest of China. She observed, Justice France observed, that there's room for differing views on this issue, and she reached her own conclusion. She said, obviously the flag is important. However, even in the United States, where the flag is such a dominant symbol, the majority concluded its protection did not warrant the interference of the criminal law. In the end, she said, I have concluded that the rational connection part of the Section 5 test, that's a reasonable limitation test, is not met here, so that the prohibition on this appellant's conduct was not a justified limit on free speech. She then turned, she couldn't just then strike down the statute, she had to turn to the question of interpretation. And she adopted Mr. Hopkinson's suggestion that the word dishonor in the flag protection statute should be read in a very narrow way to mean defile or vilify, something like urinating on the flag. She drew on a 1941 New Jersey case for this definition. And she said that this definition would be consistent with the New Zealand Bill of Rights Act, and yet it would not cover Mr. Hopkinson's conduct, so he went free. Why, apart from the obvious reason that I'm a New Zealander, have I chosen to talk about this case? Well, it involves a citation of foreign law, only this time law, a foreign court is citing our law, the United States, rather than a US court citing foreign law. And I think that turning the tables in this way is a useful shift in perspective. It helps us see, for example, that what seems like a really big deal in the American context is done easily and as a routine matter in other courts around the world. It shows how the citation of foreign law can work in constitutional cases even when there is not strong judicial review. That's the point I was making yesterday. Two issues are separable. Thirdly, I mentioned this is not a high appellate decision. The High Court is but one step up from the district court where Mr. Hopkinson was convicted. There are two appellate levels above this in the New Zealand hierarchy. This is just a regular working judge. I think, Matthew, she's been promoted to the Court of Appeal now, but nevertheless, she's a regular working judge using foreign law rather than some esteemed jurist at the highest level of our hierarchy. Fourthly, I think it's interesting that Justice France found it useful to cite foreign law, even though, as she said, the results were inconclusive, leaving some room for her own judgment. She was at pains to point up the dissensus among US Supreme Court justices, even while she was encouraged in her own holding by the majority view in Texas v. Johnson and some other cases. Finally, she cited cases from jurisdictions that were administering similar statutes under circumstances somewhat different from New Zealand. She mentioned the delicate position in Hong Kong. She mentioned the greater cult of reverence for the flag in the United States. But like any good lawyer, she was able to identify the differences and work with them, rather than simply say that because there are differences here, we can't possibly think in terms of common standards. So, here's what I want to do today. I said yesterday that we need to consider the reasons why the emergence of a common body of law common to all mankind, this jus gentium, might be important. And there are two sets of reasons I'm going to go into, two ideas that might justify the use of foreign law in American constitutional cases by reference to this idea of laws common to all mankind. One set of arguments that I want to explore is that there is something to be learned from foreign law. Our justices say this again and again. I'll argue that the jus gentium makes resources available for learning, not piecemeal, but as a body of jurisprudence containing important principles and doctrinal techniques for solving difficult legal problems. I will mainly talk about that, the learning argument, tomorrow. But clearly the case of Hopkinson is already an illustration of it. Justice France has learned from the American cases how to proceed step by step with constitutional scrutiny, distinguishing various stages in the inquiry just as an American court might do. The other line of argument I want to consider is the idea that reference to foreign law might be understood as a way of securing consistency in the way rights are administered in the world. I mean consistency in the sense of treating like cases alike. Reading the decision in Hopkinson, I got the impression that Justice France thought it important that her treatment of this man, this flag burner, should not be too far out of line with the way that flag burners the world over are treated. It was important for her to see whether his conviction in the face of free speech guarantees, for example, would introduce a jarringly dissonant note into free speech jurisprudence, not just in New Zealand, but in the world. Also, she was looking to apply this limitation provision that many modern bills of rights have, that rights may be subject to such reasonable limits as can be demonstrably justified in a free and democratic society. And she wanted that to be applied in a way that would be broadly consistent with the way that this was administered in other contexts and in other countries. So her inquiry into foreign law was in large measure a way of finding out how things stood, so far as a possible decision one way or another by her was concerned, in relation to the overall consistency or integrity of this body of law. So this is the question that has grabbed my attention for today's lecture. How important is the demand for sheer consistency, treating like cases alike, in justifying the citation of foreign law? And is this how we should understand? Should we understand the jus gentium as the product of this concern for consistency? Here's another way of raising the same question, and it's more in a sort of human rights mode. What is the case, is there a case, for attempting to harmonize the ways in which laws about basic individual and minority rights are administered all over the world? Is there a case for harmonizing human rights jurisprudence all over the world? An obvious answer says, well, yes, of course. There's a case for harmonization. What each of these countries administers under its Bill or Charter of Rights are human rights, and human rights are the same the world over. It's an argument of principle, of appealing to very deep ideas about universality. Human rights are the same everywhere. They are based on universal principles. So the law of human rights should be roughly the same in every country, give or take a margin of appreciation. There are also pragmatic arguments for harmonization. The administration of radically dissonant conceptions of rights can undermine comity between nations, making things like extradition more difficult. Harold has argued, you don't mind if I quote something from you, construing terms like equal protection, due process of law in ignorance of foreign and international precedents virtually ensures that our Supreme Court rulings will generate conflict and controversies with our closest global allies. Think, for example, of the 1989 Searing case, where it proved impossible for Virginia to extradite a young German man from the UK to be tried for the murder of the parents of his American girlfriend. This was because no credible assurance could be given that he wouldn't face the death penalty and hence suffer from the death row syndrome, which in itself is regarded in European human rights law, but not in American law, as an unacceptably cruel mode of punishment. That pragmatic argument is no doubt important, but actually I don't find the principled argument from universality convincing. I don't think it's a good argument. Universality is not going to do it for us here. I know that many human rights scholars believe that universality of human rights is sufficient by itself to justify a harmonization requirement. But harmonization with a given consensus, harmonization with a given line of decisions, doesn't guarantee that we've got the right answer. All it guarantees is that we have the same answer. Our common answer may be wrong relative to these important universal values. And if it is wrong, it might be better from the point of view of universal values if some of us moved away from the consensus and started looking anew for the right answer. In its earlier stages, that would almost certainly involve a decline in consistency. Like cases would be treated differently as different courts went off in different directions in search of this one universal common truth. So we need a better explanation than this of why consistency is important among different national courts dealing with, say, flag burning. Universality gives us a sense of why the cases are alike, but it doesn't give us our explanation of why we should all fall into line with any given global consensus, which has happened to become established on these issues. When you think about it, it's quite a deep puzzle. I thought, well, the international human rights treaties kind of assume, they sort of show that they think that some sort of harmonization is appropriate because they commit us to a single set of standards. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights doesn't say, go off and think your own private thoughts about free speech. It lays down a common line that's to stand in the name of us all on free speech. But the human rights documents don't actually give us any indication of why this is thought to be important. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights does raise the issue in the final whereas of its preamble, where it says, whereas a common understanding of these rights and freedoms is of the greatest importance for full realization of the pledge that member states have given to promote universal respect for human rights. A common understanding is of the greatest importance. This is an announcement of the value of consistency, but it's hardly an explanation. One line of argument might be that a patchwork of disparate human rights judgments, flag burners being prosecuted here, being let off there, juveniles being executed there, being let off execution over here, a patchwork would be something of a scandal. It would create an impression of relativism. It would create an impression that countries were not really signed on to the human rights enterprise at all, but were just parading their own parochial standards. That might be the impression that it created. Jeremy Bentham once said something along these lines. in response to the claim that inheritance was a natural right. Inheritance a natural right, said Bentham? How can that be when in no two nations it is the same? Right? Well, again, I think it would be unfortunate to have to fall back on this avoiding scandal or the argument. It's too presentational. It's too much a matter of packaging. It reminds me of the portion of the opinion in Planned Parenthood against Casey, where the Supreme Court said, there is a limit to the amount of error that can plausibly be imputed to prior courts. If that limit should be exceeded, disturbance of prior rulings would be taken as evidence that justifiable re-examination of principle had given way to drives for particular results in the short term. The legitimacy of the court would fade with the frequency of its vacillation. Remember that long argument about the importance of stare decisis in Casey. The Supreme Court in Casey was worried about the scandalous appearance of variation over time. This would discredit some sense that they were sticking with constant principles. We might be worried about the scandalous appearance of variation across space, across jurisdictions. Perhaps this is a reasonable concern, but does it really take us to the heart of the matter? I suspect not. In any case, aren't we getting a little ahead of ourselves here? Even if it's important that there be some sort of standardization of the way human rights are administered in the world, and we haven't shown that yet, but even if it is important that there be some standardization, who says that American constitutional law is part of that enterprise? Unless we fill in that step of the argument, that national rights law should be seen as part of global human rights law, we can talk all we like about global consistency, but it won't have any bearing on what our Supreme Court should do. You see, I've set up there, there's two steps in the argument. Right? One is that you have to show that our Bill of Rights or any national Bill of Rights should be regarded as part of this global human rights enterprise. And then even if you show that, you've then got to show that the global human rights enterprise so understood needs this element of consistency and standardization. One of the things I said yesterday that I was going to do was to try to illuminate some of the arguments against the citation of foreign law, as well as some of the arguments in its favor. And right here, you can see two possible points of opposition. You could deny the need for uniformity, or whatever one thought of that, one could deny that American constitutional rights law is to be conceived as part of that enterprise. So I'm going to focus just for a while on this side of the argument. A term that I find useful in explaining why I believe in step one is a term I don't think coined, but certainly popularized or put about by a former colleague of mine at Columbia, Jerry Newman. The term is dual positivization. Barbaric term when you think about it, but dual positivization. Human rights, like the right to free speech or religious freedom or the right not to be tortured, begin no doubt as moral ideals, but they are made into positive law at two levels. They are laid down in the form of treaties, like the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights or the Convention Against Torture. And they are also laid down at another level, made into positive law in the form of national charters, like our Bill of Rights, like the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, like the British Human Rights Act. Newman talks about dual positivization, but actually multiple positivization might be the better term because, as you know, there are regional layers in between. So you have a layer of the treaties, you have the layer of the particular national bills of rights, and you have some regional documents like the European Convention of Human Rights in between. And probably you have layers below this as well, as a particular country not only has some right embodied in its Bill of Rights, but also embodies it more concretely in legislation and regulations underlying that. So you have sort of multiple layers of positivization. The treaties at the top level are no doubt very important, but probably for most people in most rights-respecting nations, it's the national bills and charters that offer their primary and most reliable line of defense against rights violations. I'd think I was in a pretty sorry state if I had to rely just on the International Covenant for Civil and Political Rights for protecting my rights here without the benefit of a National Bill of Rights. This picture, I know, sometimes makes human rights scholars a little uneasy, as they see their turf being eroded by constitutional lawyers, but if it's any comfort, constitutional lawyers are equally uneasy as they see their turf being eroded by the human rights scholars. The answer, as my mother would say, is that they have to share. But the fact is that this is how human rights law works. The treaties are important, but the primary expectation is that treaty obligations will be fulfilled by the terms of the treaties being mirrored, more or less, in the laws and constitutions of particular nation states. It happens all over the time, all over the place with treaty law. Not just on glamorous things like human rights, but on just ordinary things like, I don't know, civil aviation treaties. Civil aviation treaties will only work if the provisions of the treaty are sort of echoed in national legislation laid down by various countries that enforce standards of aviation safety in each particular country. And so you get some, so that each particular statute, civil aviation statute in a given country, both mirrors the treaty level and mirrors the others horizontally in that line. And in that way, you get effective harmonization. So now the treaties, of course, do embody a single set of global formulations. They are already standardized just by their existence. At the level of national law, the positivization is inevitably more piecemeal and fragmentary, more of a patchwork. There are numerous distinct national documents, many of them inspired by the treaties at the top level, many of them imitative of one another, but differing in some respects slightly, in many respects significantly, as to their content and wording, and certainly as to the history of their administration, which is fine so long as each of them is considered only on its own terms, but when we consider them together as a single layer of positivization, then the patchwork aspect becomes a challenge, and maybe the introduction of some degree of harmonization becomes a need. I know that in the United States, we're really not accustomed to thinking of our Bill of Rights in this way. For one thing, our Bill of Rights is part of our Constitution, and we don't think of the Constitution as part of a worldwide consensus. We think of the Bill of Rights as part of our quintessentially American heritage. And in law schools, human rights law and constitutional law are treated as two quite different subjects. It's a bit of a wrench to have to look at the Bill of Rights as a mechanism by which we discharge international duties and play our part in common responsibilities laid down at the top level by the law of international human rights. But I think it is important to see it in this light, and here's my interpretive hypothesis. I think that what's going on in this debate about the citation of foreign law is that some judges are beginning to see national charters in this light as a layer of the positivization of global human rights law. Our Bill of Rights, after all, recognizes many of the core rights that both the international documents and other foreign charters recognize. And if somebody criticized the United States for saying that we don't recognize the human right to religious freedom, of course we would instantly cite the First Amendment, and appropriately so, and the upholding of the First Amendment as showing that we do take this human right of religious freedom very seriously. We wouldn't say the human right doesn't matter, but we have this other thing. We would say that the First Amendment really does represent our respect for this value. It's true that we've chosen to positivize our beliefs about fundamental rights in our Constitution. Some other countries like South Africa do this as well. Others like Britain and New Zealand do it with freestanding legislation. Canada does it with the Charter as part of, I think, a 1982 Constitution Act. But these points about these differences in the form of positivization shouldn't obscure the important points about continuity that we are pursuing here. The point is that we recognize these rights not just as rights for Americans, but even in the way we administer them, as fundamental rights associated with the dignity of the human person. They weren't called human rights when we embodied them in our Constitution at the end of the 18th century. The phrase wasn't used. But nevertheless, it was the US example of embodying them in a Constitution that, among others, taught the rest of the world to take them seriously. We started out as pioneers in this common enterprise, and it's now odd that we should have such difficulty in acknowledging this now. There is, of course, a darker side to this problem. The other obstacle in the way of seeing the Bill of Rights as part of global human rights law, as a layer of the positivization of human rights law, the obstacle is the path dependence of history. America was a pioneer in this business, but it was so far out in front. 1791 rather than 1960, so far out in front that there has been ample opportunity for it to follow paths that diverge substantially from those of the countries we have influenced. Our Bill of Rights predates the modern human rights movement by 150 years, and our first inclination is to say that we have elaborated very well, thank you, without much regard to the wider enterprise. Right? Not sure about that. For example, though, the American constitutional prohibition on cruel punishment is not modeled, obviously, on the inhuman treatment provision of the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, because the convention didn't exist then. It's not homegrown either. The cruel punishment formulation of the Eighth Amendment is taken directly from the English Bill of Rights of 100 years earlier. But we have given it a history that is uniquely American, and it plays a part in our identity that is uniquely American, but it's not a part of our identity that we are necessarily, that we ought necessarily to be particularly proud of. In the first 60 years, the administration of the Eighth Amendment and its state equivalents had to be reconciled with the requirements of slavery. And the story of that reconciliation is quite chilling. There might have been prohibitions on cruelty, but in slave codes, these had to be read as prohibitions on excessive whipping, beating, cutting, or wounding, or prohibitions on unnecessary tearing and biting with dogs. And there's a very good book recently published by Cullen Dayan with the story of Cruel and Unusual, which tells a story of the early jurisprudence of cruelty standards in this regard. Moreover, as you know, when we abolished slavery, we did not abolish slavery unconditionally. We abolished it with a qualification. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, shall exist within the United States. Slavery may exist, and everything that goes with slavery may exist as a punishment for crime in the United States. That's the first 13th Amendment. And that condition pretty much ensured that some of the qualifications in our understanding of cruelty, some of the qualifications that were necessary to maintain an effective system of enslavement, would continue to distort our understanding of cruelty in the subsequent operation of the penal system. As I said, Cullen Dayan has shown in her wonderful little book, The Story of Cruel and Unusual, the ways in which the twisted logic of slavery has infested the jurisprudence of the Eighth Amendment, the persistence of corporal punishment in prisons, for example, until well into the middle of the 20th century, and the difficulty of using the Eighth Amendment against it is just one illustration of this. Jim Whitman has argued that this history is radically different from the development of dignitarian jurisprudence in Europe in the penal context. There has been a sort of a leveling up tendency, outlawing the dehumanizing forms of punishment that were formerly visited upon low-status persons on the grounds that no one was any longer to be treated as of that abjectly low status, but everybody was to be attributed a certain dignity in society. Everyone who was to be punished was to be punished as though he were an errant noble rather than an errant and formerly undetected slave. So as I say, we have this antique formulation from 17th century England, and we have a history of interpreting it in light of our own peculiar institutions. And I guess all Americans know that we have to wrestle with the burden and disgrace of that history, but some think that this is nobody else's business. It's a private penance for us, and the rest of the world should leave us to grapple with our shame. While others feel that redemption here lies specifically in orienting this provision now and in the future to shared concepts of human dignity in the world, to which at some level we are also committed. Well, I mention all that just in order to show that when I say we have a different history with these provisions, I'm not talking lightly about issues. This is deep and dreadful stuff. Now, conscious of not having given you anything remotely like an argument under heading one, right, but just an illumination of what might be at stake in such an argument, but at least it would have given you a nice picture. I want to just turn a little bit to the second leg of the argument, because what I'm really doing here is showing how complicated and ramshackle an argument for sheer consistency, the value of sheer consistency, might be here. Assume that we are all on board with viewing national bills of rights as part of the global human rights enterprise. What's the case for step two of the argument. What's the case for saying that there is a need for consistency in the way that human rights are administered? Remember I said a moment ago, universality of human rights doesn't give it to us. That would equally explain people going off in different directions wherever they thought the truth was located. Well, obviously, part of what's involved here are arguments that are going to be like those arguments that are used to justify following precedent. Right? Because arguments for following precedent often depend, in some sense, on some perceived necessity to treat like cases alike, even when you're not sure you're treating them rightly. Treat like cases alike, try and maintain some degree of consistency with previous decisions. So in a sense, we're talking something like the justification of precedent here, and are asking what it is or what equivalent of it may be available in this situation. In our national law, we sometimes justify following precedent, treating like cases alike, by appealing to the need for predictability and respect for established expectations. We say it's better for the law to be settled than that we get it exactly right, because only if it is settled can it serve as a basis for people to organize their life. I doubt very much whether that argument is going to take us very far in the international context. I'm inclined to agree with those who foresee a decline in predictability as a result of the haphazard citation of foreign law, and to tell you the truth, I don't think there would be much in the way of an accrual of predictability, even if foreign law were invoked in a more thorough and principled manner. So I don't think predictability is going to be the basis of step two, or the need for predictability. It's possible that recourse to foreign law might promote predictability if people's expectations of the rights they had against their government depended as much on some broad international consensus as on the technicalities of their national law. And for all I know, that may be true in some countries. You know, maybe if you're a Dutchman, you take your sense of the rights you have against the Dutch government by reading the international documents rather than by reading the Dutch Bill of Rights. So I hope I'm not offending anybody. At any rate, I suspect that is not the case in the United States of America. So predictability won't do it. Maybe a couple of other principles will. Two other principles that are sometimes used to illuminate the idea of treating like cases alike are the principle of fairness. It is unfair to treat case B differently from the way case A was treated when the two cases are relevantly similar. Fairness. And the other one is the idea of integrity, which in Ronald Dworkin's later jurisprudence is a requirement that law be developed in a coherent way to give credibility to its standing as a characteristic of genuine community, even when the members of that community are divided about what the principles that govern them ought to be. These two ideas, fairness and integrity, are connected. In his earlier work, Dworkin used the word fairness to explain what keeping faith with a precedent amounted to. The question, he said, is whether it is fair for the government, having intervened in the way it did in the first case, to refuse its intervention in the second case. In his later work, he adopted the language of integrity and gave the term fairness a different use, but the two ideas are very close, and those are the ones I want to explore. But look, there's a very big question mark hanging over this. Treat like cases alike, we say, on grounds of fairness or on grounds of integrity. Treat like cases alike. But that sounds like an admonition addressed to a particular agent, a single person, or an institution. And surely the point about foreign cases and American cases, surely the point about Hopkinson in New Zealand and Texas v. Johnson in America, or about Roper and Simmons in America and the global consensus on the juvenile death penalty, surely the point is that there is no single agent, no single institution that could be condemned for treating these cases disparately. Treat like cases alike doesn't seem to be violated by anyone when X treats case A in a certain way and Y treats case B in a different way. It's like a little kid who complains that his friends are allowed to stay up on Sundays, whereas he has to go to bed at 7:30. It's not fair, he says. And we respond, no one's being unfair. The other parent's practices are just what they are, but they're not binding here. That's not how we deal with things in this House, right? And so somebody might say, who's violating the duty of fairness here? X is not. X probably follows precedent for all the cases within his jurisdiction. And Y probably follows precedent for all the cases. And there is no, you see the point. So we might say analogously that it can't be fairness that requires a New Zealand judge in Hopkinson to follow an American precedent even when the circumstances are the same. Why? Because the New Zealand court was not responsible for what was done in Texas against Johnson, from which it follows that the New Zealand court has no duty of fairness to let Mr. Hopkinson go free on the same basis. Other parents' practices are not binding in this House. Likewise, if we're talking about integrity, in one of Dworkin's formulations, integrity is the duty of the state to speak with a single voice, not with one voice to A and another voice to B. But there is no single state talking to Flagburner Hopkinson and Flagburner Johnson. There is one state talking to Hopkinson and another state talking to Johnson, and it's not clear who the duty to speak with a single voice is incumbent upon. So what are we going to do with this difficulty? There are two ways in which you could respond. One way is you try and stretch and find a single agent after all, right? You try and stretch and show that X and Y really are part of a single agent. The other way is to argue that the single agent requirement might in some sense be dispensable. But maybe it's a mistake to push too hard on the single agent point. We surely don't want to end up saying that what goes wrong when like cases are treated differently is just a failure of Kantian rationality on the part of some agent, as though it were purely an agent-centered concern, and that the focus of concern is on the rationality of the person treating the two cases rather than the disparity as viewed from the point of view of the parties who are suffering the treatment. If we really do think of this as an issue of fairness, maybe we ought to be focused primarily on the people, A and B, and think in terms of their having a claim to be treated alike, the claim that might be incumbent on any or all of the agencies that have dealings with any of them. It would be sort of a bottom-up demand for fairness rather than a top-down demand for fairness. So I'm going to sort of indicate that with an alternative. Maybe in some sense that these two are bound together in a certain sort of community, which makes this demand for fairness intelligible from a bottom-up point of view, then we could finesse this question mark about single agency. There are, and we might make a similar move also from an agent-focused concern to a concern for the people who are being treated differently in the case of Dworkinian integrity as well. For although Ronald Dworkin sometimes uses a state-centered formulation, as I quoted a moment ago, some other times he says that integrity requires members of a community to treat one another on the basis of a consistently administered set of principles. Again, that's a bottom-up approach, and we could in some sense say what's going on when there are disparities between the law of one country and the law of another country is that human beings are not treating one another in a mutual or reciprocal way. There are, of course, cases in between, or there's arguments in between. Cases where it's arguable that the different state entities treating A and B are linked somehow in a single system. For example, you might say, well, this is one country and this is another country. But you might say that countries work together as a system of states in administering, for example, the general arrangements in the world about citizenship and nationality. We try to work together as a system to make sure that everybody has at least one citizenship, one country that they are deemed to belong to, and that nobody sort of falls through the cracks as a stateless person. By no means perfect, but it's something that we are committed as a set of states working together to administer. And it's not something that any state could do just on its own, as if we're prepared to make everybody in the world its citizen. It's a cooperative, necessarily collective enterprise. And this actually might help explain at least one case involving the citation of foreign law by the US Supreme Court. In Trope against Dulles, which is a case from 1958, the Supreme Court ruled that depriving an individual of his citizenship was an impermissible punishment. And one of their grounds for thinking this was that the civilized nations of the world are in virtual unanimity, that statelessness is not to be imposed as a punishment for crime, which is not just that we are learning nice standards of behavior from the rest of the world, but this would screw up this common enterprise that we have of making sure that everybody belongs to one state or other. You know, so we could talk about X and Y in some sense belonging to a single system for some cases. I really don't think we should go too impulsively in that direction. I mean, I will say one or two more things about that in a minute. Anne-Marie Slaughter, whom I admire greatly, talks about the emergence in the world of a global community of courts and a global community of judges. And I'm very sympathetic to that approach. But it's got to be a community of the right sort. I hope Justice Barak will forgive me if I say that to ground a requirement of consistency, a community of judges can't just be a group of people who meet together for cocktails in Venice or the Côte d'Azur or who like or enjoy each other's company. It's wonderful that there are these social gatherings of judges, but that doesn't qualify them as a single community for the purposes of avoiding this single agent difficulty. We have to have reason to describe them as a single unit for the purposes of the principle of fairness. Well, what about the reciprocity idea, the bottom-up idea? I wonder if there's anything here. To be bound together in community is not just to think of oneself as located in the same space with a bunch of other people. It's to think of oneself as probably sharing a history and identity, as we talked about yesterday, but also to think of oneself as obligated to the others in some sort of reciprocal respect and mutual assistance, so that what others in the community are willing to do for you, you are willing to do for them. I don't want to paint that in too rosy colors, but you can think of the administration of a common body of law in that light. We're prepared to protect you from negligence, and you're prepared to help protect us from negligence. We administer a common set of standards of that sort. I'm convinced by Dworkin's argument that the mutuality of the sense of obligation helps explain why we look to what we have done for each other in the past, or why we interrogate what we're doing for each other already in order to get a sense of what it would be to carry on in that same associative spirit. I hope you don't mind domestic examples. Carol and I have a house upstate in New York, and we have a very obliging neighbor named Bobby Moore, who helps us out with various things. He plows our drive in the winter. He helps us move old lumber. Once or twice, he even cut our lawn. And let's say we do certain things in return for him, like minding his child or bringing him stuff from New York City that you can't get at the local price chopper. Now, suppose one day he came to us and asked if he could live in our house for the rest of the winter because Mrs. Moore had thrown him out. We might hesitate. And if he said, well, look at all the things I've done for you, then maybe Carol and I would have a big fight about whether the new demand that he was making was sufficiently like the previous demands that we had made on him, that some degree of reciprocity or mutuality kicked in. Well, something similar can explain the legal use of precedent. A, who has been a defendant in case after case in tort actions, and has accepted the burden of the rules which impose liability on him in that capacity, may reasonably think that when the day finally arrives and he is in the role of plaintiff in regard to a lawsuit of this sort, that he should be entitled to the benefit of the very same rules as those whose burden he previously labored under. Doesn't matter to him much whether the agent who decided the earlier cases is the same as the agent deciding this case. What matters is that he be treated fairly in his reciprocal relations with other members of the community. So maybe, at a pinch, we could come up with some similar relations of reciprocity to make sense of global community. You see how abstract and strange these arguments have to get in order to develop a bottom-up argument for fairness on a global scale. Well, it's certainly not as easy as it looks. The primary cases we're considering, human rights cases, don't really have the reciprocal structure of the cases that I've mentioned. Maybe if human rights were mostly pursued horizontally, by which I mean not just actions against the state, but actions against employers and others for violating our human rights, then maybe something like the reciprocity argument might work. But mostly the defendants or the respondents in human rights cases are states, and it's not clear how this fairness argument gets going for their benefit. I guess you could say, well, states are kind of in competition with one another, and they are limited or hobbled in that competition by being required to respect human rights. Perhaps they might demand, as a matter of fairness, a level playing field. Something like this, I think, is sometimes said in regard to the laws of war, that there's no reason why one state should accept a set of limitations of other states with whom it might be in conflict, and not also accepting similar limitations. And that would be an argument for consistency. Let's review where we are. We're sort of stuck between a conception of the fairness principle, which requires us to identify some sort of single entity at the top, and a conception of the fairness principle that requires us to identify some sort of reciprocal community at the bottom. I think, myself, there are good arguments to be said on both these fronts. You could say, and if I had more time, I would develop this, that the very existence of a human rights treaty regime at the top level of positivization indicates that, in some sense, states have bound themselves together into a single system where they have resolved jointly as well as severally to promote human rights. Right? They have, as it were, bound themselves together into this common enterprise. We can say that the system of states with responsibility for everyone's rights, that system has a duty to treat like cases alike, and then we say that individual countries and courts have a constitutive part to play in ensuring that that duty is properly discharged. I mean, it won't quite work, because maybe a better interpretation of what it means to sign up for these treaties is that each state has pledged to treat its own subjects in according with human rights, rather than to look out for the others as well. But I think, you know, you could possibly make an argument along these lines for a super agent at these levels. X and Y are part of the same human rights promoting enterprise. My hunch is that the second way through, the bottom-up idea, is more promising, and that it is possible to think of all peoples as members of a single community so far as the administration of human rights law is concerned. I don't want to be fanciful about any broader cosmopolitanism, or at least not today. I'm not talking about an all-purpose global community of all mankind, but I am talking about something like a club of us all, dedicated specifically to advancing the idea of human rights, to pressuring governments from whom we all have a lot to fear in this regard, as well as a great deal to hope for, to take rights seriously, and watching out for each other in the world in this regard. I think there is, in some sense, a community of peoples, people and peoples, of this sort. We know that human rights law, national bills of rights, didn't come into existence by magic. A historian will tell you that both ideas can be traced to the activity of certain elites, philosophers and statesmen at the end of the 18th century, and a small group of influential statesmen and diplomats in the decades following the Second World War. Those elites were certainly the immediate sponsors of these ideas, but there's a broader sense in which the emergence of individual rights guaranteed by law was the product of a popular movement among the rights bearers themselves. The people themselves, the peoples themselves, indicated that they were no longer willing to be ruled in a world without these layered guarantees. It was not the rulers primarily, but the peoples who insisted on this, though the rulers for the most part responded honorably and affirmatively to these demands. I try to emphasize this a lot in some of my other work, trying to lessen the distance between respect for rights and respect for democracy, and trying to present rights as essentially a democratic idea, as well as presenting democracy in rights-based terms. But for now, the point I want to push is that the peoples of the world have constituted themselves as a single community so far as the demand for human rights is concerned. We look out for each other in this regard, and we develop a global consensus on rights to help sustain certain demands for rights that are made here and there in the world, as well as using that consensus and perhaps to scrutinize and maybe discredit other demands that strike us as fanciful or utopian. I mean, just very briefly, think about those limitation clauses that I'm talking about, which you find all over modern bills of rights, that rights can be limited to the extent demonstrably necessary for a free and democratic society. These are based on a shared sense that claims of rights do need to sometimes to be modified for the sake of common good, and they embody a shared standard for evaluating such limitations, what can be demonstrated in a free and democratic society, any free and democratic society. It's sort of a general ideal that's appealed to. Now, there's an obvious danger that clauses like these will be used opportunistically as a sort of get out of free get-out-of-jail-free card for states and their publics that will be used whenever convenient as a way of avoiding social or political costs associated with particular rights demands in particular settings, to the detriment and demoralization of individuals who might have thought that there were rights here that they could rely on. And I could imagine an individual complaining that the reasonable limitation clause was being administered inconsistently to his detriment as between one legal system and another. Other flag-burning statutes are not given the benefit of this clause, but now in exactly similar circumstances, the flag-burning statute of his country is being upheld. He might say, I have no quarrel with the idea of such a clause, but I'm dismayed that my chapter of the global human rights community is not administering, not following the general line here to my detriment. Or I imagine, I don't know, Mr. Simmons in Roper v. Simmons. Suppose his appeal was turned down, he might have a sense of being left out of what the global human rights community is doing so far as juvenile murderers is concerned. He might concede that the juvenile death penalty is something on which reasonable opinions can differ, but he'd say in all these other cases, the human rights community through the agency of national courts and legislatures did opt to protect young men from this outcome or from analogous outcomes. But now the local chapter of the human rights community is withholding from Mr. Simmons the very protection that the human rights community writ large has accorded to other young murderers in his position. He might want to argue that if this is allowed to happen, it's unfair. He might want to argue along Dworkinian lines that we are disclosing ourselves as not really a human rights community at all, since we are somehow quickly abandoning a common standard so readily to his detriment. Well, I want to wind this up. It's pretty clear that we have not come up with cast iron arguments under either of these headings. The case has been ramshackle, and the case has revealed points of departure, points where you can get off the train at various way stations. And even the most charitable reading of what I have argued for shows only that there is something to be said for harmonizing rights adjudication with that of other countries, something to be said in the name of fairness and integrity. Certainly not that harmonization is the be-all and end-all. Other factors must be taken into account as well, including the factor that some societies might want to go off on their own in pursuit of the truth. So the argument for treating like cases alike, such as it is pretty modest and certainly wouldn't support anything remotely like courts in one country having to regard a decision by a court in another country as a binding precedent. But it may explain why there is some weight, nevertheless. Some weight to be given to the foreign cases. Why, as it were, being an outlier in relation to a consensus of other states might put one in a position of some embarrassment, so that embarrassment would have to be assuaged by stronger arguments of a different sort. And I mean, Commonwealth lawyers are familiar with this. If I'm making an argument in a New Zealand court, and my opponent cites an English case of the House of Lords or the Court of Appeal in England that is at odds with my argument against it, I can say, Your Honor, this case is not binding in New Zealand, and the judge will agree. He will say, but nevertheless, Mr. Waldron, you must be embarrassed by this disparity. I say, yes, Your Honor, I am embarrassed. However, the arguments for my position are that little bit extra strong to take care of that embarrassment. We sometimes call this persuasive authority, although that's an ambiguous term, vacillating between non-binding authority and authoritative because of its own underlying reasons. But the notion is that consistency might be a factor that is to be given weight in these settings, even if it doesn't have overwhelming weight. And the reconciliation of one's position with a foreign consensus may be a matter of some importance, even if it's not of overwhelming importance. Can I say just one last thing before I stop? The words jus gentium have barely passed my lips in the last 45 minutes. And I did want to come back to them. For most of the argument, I've been assuming we're working with just very simple cases where X, country X, the decision A, and country Y is deciding whether to follow that in the way that it does decision B. And that sort of, for expositional purposes, that sort of two-item following is the most easiest to work with. But what I have in mind, as in Roper and as in other cases, are whole lines of precedent and whole arrays of foreign cases, not just a simple one-on-one picture. The second point is this. We're sort of talking about the importance of treating like cases alike and the importance of the analogies that might be constructed between one case or another. And as you know, there are two ways of thinking about analogy in the law. One way involves thinking that analogical reasoning is a direct progress from one particular to another. It's a direct insight of movement from one case to another. The other line on analogy is, no, you're always doing it in terms of an overarching principle, right? You identify a relevant difference, you sum that up in a principle, and the principle is really what explains the analogy between the two cases. I'm a great fan of the second model rather than the first, that it really understands what the direct analogical movement from one case to another is supposed to be. So what I'm imagining is that if there is anything to this consistency business, it might require us to take seriously analogies and similarities between cases of various sorts and the treatment of cases of various sorts. And that might generate at least a notional sense of certain principles that cover cases of the same sorts. Some of those principles will become evident at the level of particular national legal systems, but some, as I said yesterday, may only become evident when we are considering the analogies that we draw between cases decided in one legal system and cases decided in another legal system, in which case the principles of the analogy that we have drawn between the cases in one legal system and the cases in another legal system, the principles can't necessarily be easily referred to either of the legal systems. They are, in a sense, common property, and it's that sense that they might be part of a broader overarching body of law, particularly if there is a sense that the same principles that I, as a judge in system Y, use for this analogy are very similar in a pairwise in the decision in another pair of cases by a judge from another country. So if France, comparing its law with that of Belgium, generates certain principles, and the United States, comparing its law with that of New Zealand, generates certain principles, and if those principles seem to be the same, there will be a sense that there is something common to be referred to, and it may seem to some extent be worth hypostasizing the principle as a genuine referable element of law at the international level. The final thing is that if you get a multiplicity of such principles, although, as I said yesterday, I don't want us to think in terms of some sort of enacted table of the principles of jus scientiam, it may be very important to begin seeing how they fit together, how they interact with one another, how they combine into complex bodies of doctrine, and how they generate, as it were, a distinctive body of legal knowledge, whereby principle one and principle two, referred to the international level, or referred to the jus scientiam level in this way, become components of a larger episteme, a larger body of knowledge available for manipulation. But that takes me to the lecture that I'm going to give tomorrow. I thank you for your patience listening to me today.